wait, if I have to like go to the bathroom or something, do I juggle like this so you can edit it out?
Can you not hold on for the length of a podcast? I mean, what are you hydrating to this extent?
You never know.
Great big crashing poem.
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute.
Not blubbering baby stuff.
We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race.
Like Oprah said, the road less traveled.
You know, that doesn't mean what everybody thinks of.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
And if you like it, I mean, if you like my poem, and if you feel it adds something to your life in any way, then you can pay me whatever you feel like.
Oh, shit, we about to get educated.
This is Molly Fuller. I'm talking to Molly about her latest book called Always a Body from Cornerstone Press. Molly is my friend, and I'm so happy to talk poetry with her. She is delightful. She's a smarty pants. Some have characterized her book as desperately sexy and beautifully deranged. That was me, actually. I said that. So, she's on the faculty part-time at Kent State University, and she's a doctoral candidate. She lives in Ohio. She has chapbooks. She's been widely published. She has a book, a previous book called Four Girls Forged by Lightning, which is also worth checking into. That's from All Nations Press. So I start off talking to her about Always a Body. So here's Molly. I hope that people, more people read it. It's doing stuff that that people aren't doing. I think it's like it's very Ariana Rhimes or just that stuff that seems really radical and different and kind of super cool.
Wow. That's like a huge compliment. Whoa, thank you. That is amazing.
No, it is. I know. If people would just would read it, they would understand what I'm talking about. So
yeah, I'll make a little plug. So This is from a little university press, University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point, Cornerstone Press. So if you buy it directly from them, it's going to support their press, and they're amazing. It's all student run. So the students help produce this book. So it's like a teaching slash class. Yeah, it's really cool. So one of the students did the artwork.
They did such a nice job.
They did such a nice job. They help edit. But then they produce it, they market it, and they're so enthusiastic. They're all really nice. Great. So it's such an amazing program and to work with all these enthusiastic students. And as a teacher myself, I'm like, I'm all for this.
Yeah.
Promoting this program. So go support them.
Oh, good. I think I said that it was kind of a disturbing book, which I really do feel like it is. But then you say, I mean, I think that you can get distracted by the beauty of it and then, but not really realize that it's like an intensely disturbing kind of book in a sense, but in the way of like, you know, that where art is supposed to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. So I feel like,
right.
Yeah, which I don't know. I tried to look up who actually said that. And I think somebody was like, as Banksy said, and wait a minute.
I don't think so.
And I'm just like, no, that is like the best. Those are the best books, are the ones that I'm like comfortable in my perturbation of.
Right. I mean, if your book doesn't disturb the reader in some tiny way, is it really poetry?
Is it doing anything? Okay, well, this is what I wanted to ask you. Because I feel like there must be, you must be having, I guess the question is, what is your primary sort of struggle with
language, with expression on the page. Well, you know, I mean, I feel like that's one of the tensions of the book, is that there is somebody that's sort of, you're saying and not saying many times. And I'm just wondering, like, if you can, you can dismiss this question out of hand if this makes no sense. But I feel like there's like, every time I'm reading it, there's like this little internal struggle that's creating this little tension about the poems. And I'm just wondering, you know, when you sit down and try to put something on the page, what is kind of that sort of primary thing that you're kind of confronting or resisting when you're writing the work?
That's a great question. So I'm thinking about this question. So I guess because some of it's prosaic, like some of it's just like prosaic life, death, right? Like trying to deal with grief and loss, and it's like, how do I say that in a new way, or like a way that hasn't been said a million times? So I guess that was sort of the struggle with this book. I kept having this idea of like tenderness and fragility, and I feel like those are two words that can be overused, or can be like, what's that word I'm looking for? Not nostalgia, but it can just be like, it risks going into sentimentality. That's the word I was looking for. So trying to write about sentimental things without being sentimental, I think that was kind of the struggle of a lot of these poems.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about breath is the measure. You're sort of saying my love is sleeping like I have killed him. And I feel like that's kind of an example of like the white space is doing a lot of work there.
Right. Oh, yes.
And I feel like, yeah, I feel that that's really, I mean, we're in this really sweet erotic space, and then but there's the specter of kind of horror,
right?
Really.
So the idea of like keeping tension, and I do think I play with white space a lot. I'm just like flipping through, and I was playing with language and white space, and in a different way than I was in my last book. So my last book was me coming out of being a trained fiction writer, mm-hmm. and like trying to figure out poetry, right? Like I'm like, what is poetry? What are these tiny prose poems that I'm even writing? And then this book was sort of me teaching myself how to write poetry. So this is my poetry MFA. This is my poetry MFA right here.
No. That's crazy. But no, but so for Girls Forged by Lightning, great book. This is, but it's prose. It's prose and poetry. Both.
Yeah, it's okay.
So
it's,
that was the transition.
That was like prose poems. So, you know, like I had my MFA in fiction, and then I was writing these tiny little things like while I was working a bunch of jobs. So like in between jobs, like traveling to the next class I was going to teach, or like on my planning period, I would write like a little paragraph, and I didn't even know what they were. They were just like tiny little stories that I could fit into like a small time. Like I would have like a half an hour, 20 minutes or whatever. And I didn't even know what I was doing. And then when I met my husband, as you know, and I like sent him some of these, and he was like, oh, you're writing prose poetry. And I was like, what? So yeah, so that's the first book. So prose poetry, microfiction, flash fiction.
Yeah.
Then this, so yeah, this is like the transition book into, okay, I'm going to try to write some poetry. Like what is this form?
Oh, that's interesting. No, that makes complete sense. I like that you can let yourself kind of go into prose too. I'm kind of struggling with that myself, because sometimes you want to say the thing, kind of the unmediated thing. And I don't know, sometimes I just wonder if this is, and maybe that's the solution, is just to go into prose and
yeah, just break all the rules, Michelle.
Yeah.
I'm here to endorse all rule breaking in all writing.
Yeah.
Across
yeah
the genres.
I've always had a problem with allowing for too many things. Like, this is it, like having a metaphor that's like, it can be this or it can be that. Like, you pick, and if you pick, then that's on you. Like, I didn't say anything. And I want to, you know, I want to get away from that and say the thing.
Right.
So maybe that's a way to, yeah, maybe that's a way to do it. Just to have, you know, a sentence with a period and have another sentence.
There you go.
And then have those build on each other until they create meaning.
Well, and I was just trying to think of like a way that you can get to that sometimes is to overwrite it, right? Like, overwrite it, be really sentimental, say all the things that you want to say, like don't obscure anything, and then look at how you can like whittle that down into something that's surprising or new, that or that is going to give the reader a different way to think about something. Kind of like you were talking about with the eco-poetics, like how many poems can we read about, you know, tree bark?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And if you want to write a poem about tree bark, then do it. Like, write everything you want to say and then go back and be like, okay, I've heard that. It's crisscross, edit.
Yeah. I've heard of people doing that. And then this might have been I work with this my mentor Ariel, and I think I was having an obsession with something. It's a word or phrase or something, and I think that her recommendation was just to to take all of that out and say foot, or say, you know, so take all your tree bark out and say, you know, lasagna, and then it becomes something where we have to kind of fill the holes in. It's very fun in terms of it being, that's a math problem, which appeals to me about poetry. It's not like a content problem. It's like a
right. And it's interesting how mathematical writing can be, because I can't do math at all, like not even slightly, but these little puzzles I'm like enjoy putting them together.
I wanted to talk about actually was Collapse, because that sort of catalogs this onslaught of just life's toxicities in all of these realms. And it's sort of it's like it's very just rendered academically, kind of objectively, but ultimately there's just like this psychosis going on, because it's just such a onslaught of acronyms and just, I mean, it's there's just so much menace kind of that you're surrounded with. And I really love that idea where we were kind of under, I guess that's a lot of why I find it disturbing, is there's a lot of things going on and even they might be about love or beauty, but there's always this menace kind of hovering in the background. You start out with kind of the colony collapse. We move on to like the chronic fatigue, and then it's like, minor dust, and then it's just, I don't know if you want to say anything more about that poem.
But. I do. I love this poem. And so as I'm working on my doctoral dissertation, I'm reading a lot of like scientific stuff for that, and about, you know, all of these things. So you know, you saying that it was academic, like it was, I was using the language of academia and really just playing with it in my own way. And then I just, this is one of those, like, you know, your secret darling poems.
Wow.
Like, so then, like, so at the end of the first stanzagraph where it says, you know, canaries dead in cages signal unsafe condition, air conditions to miners, see figure two, see also colony collapse disorder. And then the very end of the poem, it says, see figure two. So like it takes you back to the beginning. And I was just like so happy about doing that.
Yeah.
That's my little darling in this.
Yeah, that's not unusual. There's a lot of that, the repetition, kind of the nods to, it's really satisfying kind of where we're getting these nods that, you don't notice at first, but there are phrases that have come up before. It's really great. Oh, that's really great. That's funny that that you say that. And also that was there was another question about when I was reading the book as a whole, which was great to do it. I found this theme of like things that are missing, things that are unsaid, things that are unspoken all the time. That's one of them, really, like figure two, like where is that? Right. I mean, I don't know if there's, in fact, I think that's a lot of that kind of vulnerability of the speaker. Sometimes it's a person that is saying things to the speaker or is out there, or it's just information. And we're sort of riding along with the speaker in this way. We're experiencing what, you know, she must be experiencing, but we're not hearing that directly. Like it's really strategic where there's something hovering that we all kind of know about, but the poem doesn't necessarily have to say that. And that's kind of an example of that a little bit, maybe. I don't know if there's a, do you have a relationship with, you know, the unsaid in general, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. And I was just thinking when you said the idea of like there being like a little bit of menace. So I studied the minimalists when I was doing fiction, and like Raymond Carver and Amy Hempel and Anne Beatty were kind of like the writers that I was really into. And Raymond Carver said something, I can't think of the exact quote, but it's like that idea of like there's always like an undercurrent of menace in the story. And then because those are minimalist stories, and I know I'm talking a lot about fiction for a poetry book, which is kind of funny to me right now, but it's like that was one of my like sort of puzzling things out as a writer, like what can I leave out that is going to give the reader space to put sort of their own twist on it, but then also is going to be a little disturbing or menacing and give it that little edge. So definitely.
It's really effective. I can see that in almost in a little bit in Family History, but it's almost the inversion of that, which is kind of this poem about the, you know, encountering the, like the form, the hospital form.
Right.
And we're sort of getting everything that isn't gonna be on that
form. Right.
So it's kind of like the opposite of that, kind of a nod to the missing, whatever's missing from that form. That is amazing. It's a heartbreaking poem somehow without any sentimentality. I mean, it's really objective, but it's just, that really gets me.
It's all these like objective scientific measures of the body that is not objective or scientific or measurable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a poem that's Splits and Clamps. I thought would be really interesting to read. It also plays with form a bit. It's very, there's a sort of allusions to war and certainly violence and some menace there in a really unique way. And I thought that would be interesting to read if you wanted to read that one.
Yes. The wind is the soldier they considered an enemy, splits and clamps soon after, the winding, the width and horizontal of the narrow road, going slower, change gears, high perch. The bridge extends over, sings over, a stone to drown, sending them to kill, maybe a lover or child. Borders are arbitrary except when they are not. The narrow road, empty bread baskets, shifting gears, high noise extends above the singing. A stone to sink is invisible to God, running out of water, forgiveness. The high wine of the winch, dirt, it is all dry clay, Shovels are bending toward a purpose, a longing for wet mud to hold the dead. The wind is an army. The narrow roads, the width of the horizon, turn high places once growing into dead progress. Send them to kill, to their deaths. Frontiers tear and pinch. The sinking stone is invisible. Running godless, all dirt is dry, all earth is clay. Trowels mangled, bent toward a destination, looking for wet mud to fill with the dead. The wind is a ghost, is a soldier, is the dead, is the mud filled with bodies, is the dirt, the dirt, the dirt, the wind. There's like a couple in here that, I mean, definitely concerned with climate catastrophe, you know, the climate catastrophe that we're living through and pretending like we're not. There's, you know, the genocide that we're living through. Obviously, this was written before that, but
there's always one state of the.
Yeah, you know, like just the state of the world and it being like this puzzling, violent, apocalyptic sort of horizon to me sometimes, like while I'm trying to say, like, write this dissertation or do the dishes, and then the news is like, you know, terrible. So I guess it was me sort of trying to deal with all of that stuff, because I know there's like this poem, there's another one that was definitely inspired by, it's on page 31. It's called Prayer. And that one was when we were like keeping children in cages, like just horrific stuff like that. Yep. I mean, I don't want to call them political because they're, I mean, I guess all poetry is political, right?
But... Yes. What I wanted to have you do is read. And speaking of having these kind of beautiful poems, prose poems, actually, I was wondering if you could read Hold. Gina, yeah. I really love this poem.
Thank you.
And I think it does. I don't know. Maybe you can say something about the prose of that, because obviously you've gone back to some prose poems in this book. They're maybe less restrictive and all that, but there's also that element of poetry in them where they have these patterns and they're rhythmic, and I think that this one does that, and it's really beautiful. And but prose seems to be the form that one took, which I think is really nice for it.
Yeah. Actually, one of the first things I wrote when I started writing again, I feel like, so this is a really,
really?
Old piece, uh-huh. And it just worked into this book so nicely. So I love that you picked this one. All right, so this is called Hold. This night, in separate cities for different reasons than usual, I want to bridge this space between you and me in the same way our mouths collapse our bodies together, the same way our arms fold over the small spaces where our bodies gap in embracing, and press you against me. You are doing something I don't like to think of you doing alone, watching your mother die. Later, you will tell me how you were looking out of the hospital window at the city below, imagining what each person might understand under the lamp of their own light. And in that instant, you spoke out loud to me, forgetting that I wasn't there. And I will tell you how, in that moment, I was lying in my bed, holding my breath to better hear your voice.
Aww.
That's such a sweet poem.
It really is.
It's so tender. Yeah.
It's also traverses like time and space, but in this little box.
Yeah.
It's really well. Right? Yeah.
Now, are you feeling so that was nostalgic for some of your older work?
Yeah. Wasn't it funny, like, how it comes up? Like, it was in a chat book, like my first.
Oh, it's been around a long time.
My first chat book.
But it stood the test of time. Wow.
Yeah, like. Yeah, it has another life here because it just worked out because and the one, okay, let's see, that one and that one. I'm trying to think of how many that I don't feel like there's that many old ones that made it into here, but like that one and the one right next to it did. And the very last poem in the book is also one that was an older piece.
Wow. Yeah.
It stood the test of time and came back in.
I like that they end with a few of those. There's something about them maybe that lends itself to sort of, you want to end on a softer note maybe or something.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and like this whole section of the book is more like, is like that, you know, that poem, I think it's more tender, like, well, the first poem isn't. I say that and I look back and I'm like, wait, no, that's not. But like, I feel like it sort of, yeah, tends toward that tenderness at the end. And that's always been a little bit of a preoccupation of mine, and is that idea of like, you know, we're so fragile. We're such fragile bags of bones.
You don't want to send us on our way being traumatized. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Just a little tenderness at the end.
A little treat.
Pardon My French is produced by Michelle Lewis. Engineering and audio production by David Brubaker at Off Road Music Studio.